What up, what up, what up? Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, it's me, Michael Steele. They haven't knocked me down yet. I'm still here, still fighting, and hope you would join the fight with me. You can catch us, obviously, on, you know, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts on. Don't forget to do the download thing because that's important, right? That's how you listen. And so you can certainly follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, I'm very excited to have this brother on with me today. I've gotten to know him since his run for the presidency in 2016. In fact, I can say I voted for this man for president of the United States. In 2016, and it is a real pleasure to have Evan McMullen on the podcast today. He's a former CIA operative, 2016 independent conservative presidential candidate, and co-founder of Stand Up Republic. And in fact, they put on a tremendous event last week here in D.C., the National Summit for Democracy, which I had an opportunity to speak at. But what was so exciting was to see that there are a lot of folks out there that are genuinely concerned about the state of our country, the direction of our democracy, and are willing to put their names, their faces, and their bodies into the game. And that's because Evan has been able to lift up something that people see as a bright, shining light to move towards. And I appreciate your efforts in that regard, Evan. Welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you. And thank you so much for speaking at the summit. I mean, you were phenomenal, and it was sort of the perfect message. It's easy when we consider sort of the state of our country and the direction that it's headed in under its current leadership. It's easy to be discouraged, but boy, you really charged people up and gave them some, energy for the fight. And we just can't thank you enough for sharing your time and thoughts with everybody. And it was a cross-partisan convening. We had people from, Republicans and Democrats and independents there, and everybody united around defending fundamental American values and institutions, the same that protect our freedom. And it was great to have you there.
No, it's great. And in fact, you had two members of Congress. They were there for the dinner program that I was a part of. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware and Senator Representative Kathleen Rice of New York, who both, I thought, gave some very interesting insights into the current state of both the House and the Senate. And you can almost see in some cases their frustration with the inability to just move on simple stuff, to get, just to get the basic stuff done on the Hill, because it is so tribal and so polarized. And a lot of these members from my conversations with them, and I'm curious if you have the same experience, are looking for ports of storm. They're looking for some place to go where they can get positive feedback from folks to say, yeah, keep doing that, keep moving in that direction, because they don't necessarily get it inside the chambers.
Yeah, that's right. And also they don't always get it from their constituencies, at least within their parties these days. And that's the problem. I mean, I think you said it perfectly. They're looking for safe harbor. And another way to put that is they're looking for and in need of constituencies that will, that will support unifying and effective leadership rather than, the rote ideological orthodoxy and partisanship that is sending both parties towards their fringes. Now, I think that's clearly happening with the Republican Party, and I hope it reverses. Obviously, we're fighting for that. The Democrats now have a fight on their hands with, a rising far left, but you also have some good moderates as well, and it's unclear in what direction the Democratic Party will go at this point. And I think the nominating process through the primaries will clarify that. But it's so important in that environment that Americans come together and support leaders from whichever party affiliation they have, either the leaders or themselves, but leaders who are going to be committed to truth and committed to our values and to finding solutions, you know, appropriate solutions for the American people.
So folks get a better sense of what you've done. We're familiar, very familiar with the independent run for the presidency in 2016.
Right.
And coming off of that, and I remember at the time when you were moving out of the box and into that space, there was a lot of very positive chatter, in the party, and a lot of concern about what could come from, you know, Trump actually becoming president at the time, and a lot of that's been borne out since then. So you leave that space, you sort of place a marker there, and then when the race is over, the battle is done, you say, no, the battle is not done. In fact, the battle's just beginning, and Stand Up Republic was born. Tell us a little bit about that effort and how it translates into, you know, 2 years later now, or 3 years later, into what we see happening across the country.
Yeah, well, that's great, Michael. You know, we, Mindy and I, and my running mate, Mindy Finn and I, we expected, like most of the country, that Donald Trump would not prevail in 2016, and we were wrong, and he did. But what we thought was that after our brief 3-month campaign, that there would be a fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. Trump, you know, we expected, as I said, would lose, excuse me, and then we would be part of a fight for the direction of the party going forward. And we feared that, you know, that would be quite a fight, given that, you know, Trump had empowered some dangerous ideas and movements within the Republican Party. But obviously, it didn't work out that way. And so, just as you said, we realized that we needed to have another fight, and perhaps a more important fight, a more fundamental fight, which was to recommit all Americans and to unify all Americans around our fundamental values. And as I said before, the institutions that protect liberty and justice in America, just at a very basic level. And so that's what we started doing. And, you know, the first thing we felt we needed to deal with was foreign interference in our political systems, especially Russian interference. So we challenged Trump right away on what we thought was his cooperation in some capacity with the Russian attack on our democracy. We pushed for investigations. We've since then pushed for protections for Mueller. We pushed for sanctions on Russia successfully, defended those against efforts to weaken them or to block them. And that's what we've done. And we've done it with the help of Americans across the country. And again, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, all of them who have joined the cause at Stand Up Republic. Now we've got organizations in 25 states and members in every state, donors in every state. And they have helped us fight these fights at the national level. Now going forward, you know, the way we think about it is, you know, there's defending our Democratic Republic. And that's important. And we've spent the first couple of years of the existence of the organization doing that. But the next phase is actually strengthening our system of self-government. And so that means, you know, pushing for reforms like independent redistricting commissions or committees. Right. So fighting gerrymandering. You know, we're looking at things like ranked choice voting, which is now the system in Maine, which allows voters to more fully express their preferences when they vote, and it inspires leaders to take a more unifying approach to you know, their work. And so we're you know, that's sort of the next phase, is not only defending our system of self-rule, but making it stronger.
That's an important aspect of our politics that I think is kind of getting swept under the carpet, is the strengthening, the reaffirming of our democratic ideals and principles. Yes, it's messy, you know, and we've made some profoundly stupid mistakes over our 200 plus year history. But there's a certain resilience that I think speaks so well to the very character of this country. It's like I said, you know, at your event, you know, people still, you know, when they think about, okay, where do I want to go? If I'm going to leave my country, where's the one place on this planet I want to go? It's coming here. It's still, there's still, the lights are on here in the hearts and minds of a lot of people around the globe. And it's because of the very things you're talking about that are important. But that requires a kind of work that, quite honestly, I just see a lot of people, a lot of the elected officials in the Republican Party giving up on doing. It is easier to capitulate to the crazy of Donald Trump and to undermine the very value sets that William F. Buckley and Ronald Reagan and so many others helped establish in the mid to late 20th century around this idea of a modern conservative party than it is to, support those things that really matter and to reaffirm those things and say, you know, I get it. Supreme Court justice, I like. That's great. I appreciate that. And yeah, everyone likes a tax cut, particularly if you do it right. But you don't need to spend all this money. You know, you can have those lines drawn, I think, Evan. But we're beyond that. I mean, we've just sort of said it's just enough to get what we want. And everything else be damned. And that, to me, is a problem. It's like a parent who says, well, Johnny's getting straight A's even though he's a terror in the neighborhood. You know, he's right. hanging cats and you know, toilet papering people's homes, and the neighbors are complaining, and they're pissed off, but we're okay because Johnny's getting straight A's.
Like, right.
He's doing well in school, but what he's doing outside of school is a problem. And it goes to the character of the kid, in this case, the character man in the Oval Office, his behavior, his words, all those things still matter, despite the fact that he's, you know, he may be giving you what you want.
Yeah, you know, look, there's so much baked into that, you know, that we could spend hours talking about, and we should at some point. But but you know, I'll say, Michael, that I think that, you know, that we take our freedom for granted is what I have to say.
Yeah,
you know, I think that, and I've been guilty of this in the past too, where you sort of think, look, this is America, we're the greatest country on earth. We've got this great history. We've got this constitution. None of it is perfect. And as you said correctly, we've made mistakes, but we've got this culture that protects our basic rights. And, you know, we're going to be okay. And we're always going to be okay. But the reality is that's not how any of this works. And in fact, our founders understood that very well, which is why they did everything they could to set up all these checks and balances and to make it very difficult for any one person to amass too much power, because they were right about human nature. And that is that, you know, that kind of power ends up corrupting and leads to abuses and then infringements upon our basic rights. And so, you know, but I think we've started to take that for granted, because it's been a while since we've had an existential threat to our liberty. 9/11, I think, fits in that category, but a lot of people, you know, were quite young then, and that, you know, that passed relatively quickly, although, of course, the resulting wars continue. But you know, I think that we've become complacent. You know, we've become complacent, and we don't understand how our system of government anymore protects our basic rights, and we don't really know what it feels like to have those basic rights denied us, you know. And so, you know, that's one thing that I think we have to get past, and I think a lot of people actually are waking up in this Trump situation, and that's good. I wish more Republicans would too, and you know, that's an interesting element of this. Why aren't they? That's an interesting question. But I think most Americans are sort of waking up to, oh, you know, separation of powers really is important. And yeah, the fact that we have a constitution and it has the checks built in that it does, that's really important. And a lot of people on the left who may not have, you know, talked much about the constitution in the past now do. And that's a great thing. So there's a silver lining to all of this, but we got a lot of work to do still.
Well, and speaking of the work that remains to be done and the role that Republicans can play in all of this, let's talk about CPAC. So the Conservative Action PAC took place last week here in my backyard in Prince George's County at National Harbor. And the president came and performed, because that's all I could call it. He performed for 2 hours, 2 hours right. and 20 minutes. And in the course of that performance, it was a at times vulgar, certainly most times rambling speech that really you watch it and you just kind of shake your head and go, okay, this is the bottom of the reality TV presidency right here. What do you think was going right. What do you think is going on when you see the president do that? Is it his way of sort of just sort of letting it all out, given the events of the prior week, the Michael Cohen testimonies, the revelations that are coming out of that, the tensions that are still sort of swirling around, waiting for Mueller to show up with his birthday surprises. How do you contextualize the president's performance at CPAC and, by extension, mm-hmm. CPAC itself, which is something that I've spent many years attending, had been invited to speak at and have, and of course did not go this year on the heels of the comments of the leadership of CPAC at last year's event about me, just, you know, out of the blue, say, oh, well, the only reason we elected Mike Steele is because he's a black man. And then to have Matt Schlapp sort of double down on that and said that I was the one that needed to be graceful. You know, his racism and their racism, I should appreciate and accept that for what it is. What the hell's going on with these people? In my thinking, it's become a shit show. There's nothing conservative about it. There's no debating of policy. No, it's all kind of waiting for the grand performance by the guy who, by the way, 3 years before wasn't even welcomed at CPAC. And they didn't want Trump to speak leading up to the presidential campaign, and he didn't. And now they can't fall over themselves enough, holding up the MAGA signs. I don't know. Was there something in the water that we clearly didn't drink, or what?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, it's gotten to that point where it's, for a lot of people, it's party over country. You know, we've ended up in these tribes for a variety of reasons, and we care more about that tribe than we do the country, and we see members of the other tribe as an enemy and not even rightful members of our shared nation, and that's a dangerous place to be. And you know, I saw what they did to you last year and what they said about you. And, you know, I was so saddened by that. You know, I saw that, and I just, and especially when Matt Schlapp doubled down on that, it just made it clear that, look, this is the direction of the Republican Party leaders now, both the activist leaders and the others. And I don't think that's where all Republicans are by any means, but that's the direction of the leadership, and that's where leadership is trying to take the party under Trump's guidance, obviously. But it's unfortunate, you know. For years, men like you and women, others who were in the party, and I tried to do what I could too, working in my capacity and in the House, tried to move the party forward, tried to make it more inclusive to, you know, different communities, ethnic communities, religious communities, you know, open, you know, more for women and others, so that it wouldn't just be sort of a party of people who look like me. And you know, we weren't successful in that. And now the party seems to be, at least the leadership, moving in another direction. And it's leaving a lot of Republicans who aren't willing to go in that direction feeling politically homeless. And, you know, a lot of those people are now with Stand Up Republic. But, you know, it's a tough time, but that was tough to say and to see. And I just got to say, I was so impressed by how you handled it. I would not have handled it that well, but you sort of, you know, you sort of took it in stride and tried to use it as a teaching moment, which I thought spoke, volumes about you as a leader. And boy, if we could have you back as the chair of the RNC again, I think that would be a good sign. But look, I think that as far as Trump's rhetoric is concerned at CPAC, you notice there was a coarsening of the rhetoric. I mean, he attacked Mueller, as he does all the time, and he went after immigrants, and you know, he did his usual thing, and Democrats, of course. But there was a certain coarsening of the tone, you know, around Mueller. You know, he said they were trying to attack him, and it was, you know, BS. He said the whole word. And that was a new thing, and even repeated it as right. though to do so with purpose. And I actually think there was a purpose, and that purpose was the following. At CPAC, you're talking to the base of the base. You're talking to the people who, you know, influence the base and guide the base. And so the message that he was sending, expecting more revelations to come from the different Trump-Russia investigations, especially the Mueller investigation, what he was signaling to his base is to toughen up, to coarsen up, to ignore the facts, to become more obstinate, to become more fearful and hateful. And that is what he was doing, preparing them for more damaging facts to come from the various investigations of Trump and Trump world. And that told me that, okay, you know, we're in for something, we're in for some tough times going forward. And I think Trump knows more about that than just about anybody else, the special counsel.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Jonah Goldberg, who I admire a lot, I love his writing. He wrote a piece sort of, you know, on the heels of the CPAC event. And he made a very interesting point near the end of it. He says that the interesting thing about the Trump era for conservatives has been trying to navigate between supporting the man's policies and supporting the man. And that's how we kind of started this conversation where and it was something certainly you have talked about and drawn out. I've talked about and drawn out that. Yeah. There are aspects of policies where you could say, OK, good. Yeah. Deregulation is a good thing. Tax cuts are great, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then the challenge is, and this is what I don't get, the challenge is, why is that so consuming? You know, Goldberg goes on, he notes that, you know, you never heard any serious Republican or conservative defend H.W. Bush, 41, by saying, well, at least he's better than Michael Dukakis would have been. Or denouncing conservative critics of the president as being secret Michael Dukakis supporters. You never heard right. that. So what I'm trying to figure out is, what the hell is it about Donald Trump that has given certain conservatives mad cow disease? I don't get it. The visceral, need, desire to defend the completely and utterly indefensible, where they completely separate any character related to the man from a policy. The evangelical community is the best prime example for me, where for 30 plus years, these folks told us how to live our lives and who we should love and what was right and what was wrong, and damning us if, you know, we're stooping the babysitter and messing around with our on our wives and all this other stuff. And then they get behind a guy who's done all that and more, and they're like, well, you know, at least he's giving us a Supreme Court nominee we like.
Right.
Please tell me, what drug is that so we can get an antidote? Because that, to me, is one of the most dangerous aspects of this, when that's your fallback, that's your defensive line, is, well, he's better than Hillary Clinton would have been, and anyone who doesn't support him, Michael Steele and Evan McMullen, well, you're secret Democrats, you're rhinos, you're all this other BS that they throw at you.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think you and I and so many others are going to be studying that question for probably decades, and I think it warrants that kind of study. I mean, my shorthand for understanding it is that, you know, Trump is if there's one thing he's good at, there are a couple of things. One of the things he's good at is figuring out what your deepest fear is and what your what your bottom line is, what you want most. And he says to you, okay, you know, you have reason to be afraid on whatever issue, and here, let me stoke that fear a little bit for you so you feel it even more. And then in addition to that, look, I'm going to give you exactly what you want, even if it's no one else would give this to you because, you know, maybe there's not support for it or it was difficult or whatever, it wasn't fiscally responsible or whatever. I'm going to give it to you. And then you're going to turn the other way while I do all this other stuff. And by the way, all that other stuff has to do with breaking down our constitutional system of government.
Right.
But you've sort of forgotten about how important that is. So you don't really care about that anyway. I'm gonna deliver some other things for you that you haven't forgotten about. And then people make that Faustian bargain, right? But that's not where it ends, because once you make that bargain, I mean, this is true in so many aspects of life, but once you make that bargain, then you own it. Then it becomes you. And then you become defensive of it, not just for Trump, but for you, because you own it now,
well, it
and you know you own it.
It
so
legitimizes
you have to fight for it, too.
Yeah, that's your. It legitimizes where the position you've taken, and that you're always looking for affirmation.
Right.
You're always looking for confirmation of that position, because
right.
God forbid you realize, well, this is a dumbass spot to be in. You know, I was like, I should move on to something. I don't think I could do this by myself. So you're always looking for someone else to affirm that. And you're right. Trump gives them that. He comes. I mean, I say all the time, the interesting dynamic about the Trump phenomenon in politics and what makes it work is he's done something no other candidate had done up to this point, which will be interesting going forward to see how it works. But because of his media presence, he'd been on television, he runs pageants, he was on page 6 of the Post, you know, New York Post. So people had a familiarity with him, they knew him, he'd been in their living rooms, he'd been in their, you know, their conversations around the water cooler kind of deal, you know, you're fired. And everyone's like, oh, did you see last night's episode? Those viewers, he turned into his voters. And they have this sort of symbiotic relationship with him that reaches back beyond politics. It'll be interesting to see when you're looking at the likes of a Beto O'Rourke and an Ocasio-Cortez and others who use social media. I mean, you look at Ocasio-Cortez went from something like, you know, 15 or 20,000 followers on Twitter, right, to now almost 3 million. And
yeah,
so
it's this
social mediaization of these political characters. Well, actually kind of making them political characters that are playing in a role in a bigger staged production, and how that impacts the nation's policies and politics going forward.
Well, right. And, you know, the more divided, and this isn't just, you know, a line. Pew Research actually has tracked this over decades. But, you know, as recently as 2004, you know, the parties were mostly ideologically overlapping.
Right.
Of course, Republicans were a little more conservative. Democrats were a little more liberal. And I encourage the listeners to check this out. You can search for it. But you know, under Pew Political Polarization, you'll find what I'm talking about. But since 2004, the parties have moved away from each other, and they've become and towards their fringes. And the same is true, yes, for both parties. And I know you get in trouble for saying that these days, but it's true. Those are the facts. And the Republicans, I think, are a little bit farther down the road of that. I mean, we now have a president who is a representative of the populist nationalist movement. The Democrats, it's unclear sort of where they'll end up. I mean, they took the House by uniting with moderates and with anti-Trump Republicans to take the House.
Right.
And there were a lot of great Democrats who were elected, like Ben McAdams in Utah and Abigail Spanberger in Virginia in Republican districts and others. You've got Dan McCready down there in North Carolina, mm-hmm. who you know was. You know, there was some election fraud down there done by the Republican candidate, and there's going to be a do-over there, so we'll see what happens. But there are some, you know, some unifying Democrats that are being elected, but it's unclear sort of where the party will go. Will they win or will the far left win? It's just unclear. But I'll tell you, in that polarized environment where, you know, each side thinks the other side is the enemy, and that you're either part of you know, you're the tribe or you're against the tribe and that sort of thing, really does create a dynamic in which, you know, leftist populism and far-right populism and their leaders can throw out policy proposals and play on the that make no sense and play on the fears of people in their tribe. And boy, that takes off like a rocket, right, on social media for sure.
Yeah, it's one of those aspects of this current environment for me that I'm keeping an eye on, because, you know, either Trump's a one-off and things kind of revert to, the people want to revert to something where the expectations of their leadership has meaning, and they look at these individuals in total context as opposed to just sort of out of context and say, well, you know, at least he's promising me clean air and clean water and that's enough, you know. Or they're saying, no, well, yeah, it matters to me whether or not you know, he got arrested for, you know, drunk driving or something else, you know. So it's
right.
And
character.
Yeah, character matters. I believe it does. I still think it should matter to all of us, because at the end of the day, these leaders reflect us. They reflect our values and who we are.
Right.
And if you're saying to me that Donald Trump is the best representation of who we are right now, well, that says a lot. That says a lot about where we are. And it was why I say in my speeches around the country, we are where we are because this is where you want us to be. And the people get upset. Oh, I didn't vote for him. I said, that's not the point. That doesn't matter. We're all in this together. This is what a republic looks like. You know, we're all in this together. And we are a republic that use, you know, democratic ties up to tie our, you know, shoestring, if you will, to tie our collective shoes together. And here we are. So we all kind of walk the same way on this thing. And if it matters to you, then you got to go out and change the system.
I feel like, you know, people like you and me, we harp on that and rightly so, and too often it doesn't seem to penetrate and impact the people who need it to. But it really does matter. I mean, you just think about, you know, your newest member of the House, just a rank and file member of the House of Representatives, onto a senator, and certainly onto the president and governors. All of those people, all of those officials, have tremendous powers. Even the most green member of the House, mm-hmm. You know, one of 435, even that member has tremendous power. And despite all our checks and balances and ethics laws and all of that, the reality is that they have quite a lot of leeway to exercise their power. And we can't always track and see everything they do. And so as a result of that, we need to make sure that our leaders have integrity and that they're people of high character, because we simply can't see everything they do and micromanage and have total transparency in every action, every conversation, you know, every donation.
Right.
We just will never get to that level. And so we have to have some level of trust. And the only way we can get to that level of trust is if we establish that they are people of character and integrity. That's why it's so important. And if we bring people into office who are people of low integrity and low character, then we can't trust them. And most likely they'll abuse their powers in ways that we may never know. Some of it will be visible, maybe eventually. A lot of it will never be visible. And it can be just the smallest things that add up over time that end up completely corrupting our system of self-government. That's why it's just so critical that we find leaders with high levels of character and integrity.
Do you think people stop caring about that?
I think they have, but it's because I think people, you know, they underestimate how important it is, and that's why I think it's so important that we explain, you know, make our case at least as to why it is so important. I mean, we can't take our freedoms for granted. We really can't. We can't trust anybody. We really can't. Not, you know, we can't trust even if they're members of our own party. We must, you know, trust but verify, right?
Right.
Even leaders of our own party, we've got to do that. But we can have more trust, and it's easier to verify when we have leaders of high character, leaders of good character who do their work with integrity And right now we have a president setting an example of the opposite. And of course, way too many people buying into that. And I hope that eventually more people sort of see the light on that. And maybe Trump will cause the pendulum to swing back in the other direction.
Well, you know, I hope you're right about that. I think that for me, that's going to be an interesting test in this cycle. In 2018, I tweeted out the weekend before the election just two questions. I just put it out and say, hey, you know, the elections are coming up. There are two questions you need to answer. What kind of country do you want, and what kind of leaders do you want to run it? And right. I think that that is, for me, the sort of the cornerstone going into this cycle. What kind of country do we want, and what kind of president do we want to lead it? And if it's just enough that you get your cookies, you get the goodies that you want, and you don't care who gives them to you, then we're going to get that, and we're going to get what comes from that. But if you care about something more than just getting your goodies, just getting your votes, you know, the way you want them, getting your courts and you know, policies the way you want it, then you're going to have to look at it differently. I think you're going to come to some different conclusions about who best represents you and best represents the kind of America you want the country to be. Do you want to continue to be a shining city on the hill, or do you want to turn the lights out? I mean, that's
the question.
That's the question. And right now we have someone who wants to turn the lights out, and in the process of turning the lights out, build a wall and you know, give effectively our enemies free reign in the world. And that to me is a real problem. And it may not be for, you know, a majority of Americans, or maybe a plurality of Americans, depending on how the vote goes. But it is something I think we need to think about. And when you talk about, you know, our role in the world and how that plays out, you have a president who is enamored of you know, despots and dictators and demagogues. And he is trying his best to emulate them in ways that should be disturbing to most people. But apparently it's not. And that's worrisome to some degree. And so when you look at where, you know, what we saw happen last week in Hanoi with the president's summit with Kim Jong-un, which by all accounts was a mess. The president was not prepared to go there and do what needed to be done. I think that that's why it short-circuited the way it did, because North Korea came to the table and, you know, insisted on things that, fortunately, some in the president's foreign policy corner thought was problematic. North Korea is continuing their nuclear missile nuclear program. South Korea military is, you know, on high alert because their facilities, those North Korean facilities, are active, and you know, their efforts being put in place at that intercontinental missile ballistic missile plant there, that should be bothersome. Where do you see all of this right now? Is it just about the photo ops that and the love letters between the president and Kim Jong-un?
Yeah.
Or are there other things that we need to be focused on and worried about right now?
Well, look, I think for the president, look, I will say, I think the president would love to have a real nuclear disarmament in North Korea. Of course, he would love for that. And so would his administration. We would all love that to happen. You know, and I'll say, Michael, I'm open to unorthodox approaches to that challenge, because I think we are in a terrible position as a country, having allowed this to go on with North Korea as long as it has. And I don't think it's likely at all that they are going to give up their nuclear program or their long-range missile program. because I think they look around and they say, look, you know, look what happens if when the Indians and the Pakistanis push forward with their programs. Eventually, you know, the world allowed them to have them. Look at what happened to Gaddafi after he gave his up. You know, they're learning lessons. Look at Iran. Iran was able to advance its program far enough that even when, you know, the international community did come together to try to do something about it, the Iranians got to keep their program, essentially. It was slowed down and it halted in some ways, but they still got to keep their program because it was so advanced. They were able to negotiate part of it away, but not all of it away. Anyway, the point is that Kim Jong-un looks at all that and he says, look, the faster I can build this thing, the further it gets, the more I'll have to negotiate with, and I won't have to give this thing up. And I need it, by the way, in order to ensure my regime's survival, the survival of my own leadership. That's the way he thinks. And so when you get to a question that's existential for a totalitarian leader like Kim Jong-un, it is going to be very hard to convince him to give his weapon programs up. I'm open to unorthodox approaches. Trump has certainly taken one. I've been concerned, though, that he has sort of stepped on the toes of his experts. I think that's been a mistake. And you know what? He made one big mistake going into Hanoi, where he was out-Trumped by Kim Jong-un,
right,
so to speak. And that Kim did what Trump said before going into those negotiations was, look, you know, we're in no hurry here. And as long as the North Koreans stop or don't resume their testing, their missile and their nuke testing, we're okay. You know, that's the main thing. And so he was trying to set expectations. I understand that. He was trying to manage those. But the message that he sent with those words to the North Koreans and to Kim Jong-un was, hey, this is my red line. All I want is to make sure that you don't start those tests again. And as long as you do that, then I can tell the American people that we're in a better place than we were before the discussion started. And there aren't these big news moments where North Korea's exploded another nuke or tested another missile. And that allows Trump to say, see, it's been a success. And so basically what North Korea did with that is say, okay, well, if that's your red line, if that's all you really want is sort of this apparent progress, even while we continue to produce fissile material and advance our programs, well, then that's what we're going to give you, and we're not going to give up anything else. So they found what he wanted most, and they're giving it to him. Meanwhile, they're continuing their program. So he made a terrible negotiating mistake in that.
And, you know, got the requisite egg on the face. Talks broke down and then they walk away. It was not a Reykjavik moment for sure. And there were some who were trying to paint Trump as, having held the line and just, being firm and walking away. No, I think you got it exactly right. The way that went down was, okay, they were reading what you were saying coming into the game. And when you got there, they played it back and said, that's what we're willing to do. That's what you said you want. Here we are. And meanwhile, they were still, while they were meeting in Hanoi, the North Koreans were still making efforts to restore their satellite launching station and at the same time. So, you know, it's one of those situations where, I'm sorry, Mr. President, you got to read the briefing material.
You just got to read it.
You know, you just got to read it. And you've got to make this a part of your understanding how your adversaries operate. And part of the problem is you don't see them as adversaries. You see them as I know he has visions of Trump Hotel, beyond paying it or whatever in his head, that's just not how this should play out. But there we are. One last thing before I let you go, a little interesting, again, speaks to the moments that we're in. There was the big scuttlebutt over Representative Ilhan Omar's anti-Semitic comments.
Yeah.
She had suggested that Israel supporters have an allegiance to a foreign country. And that right. angered. What was interesting was the response from Democrats and certainly the Democratic leadership, in which they were on the verge of you know, censoring her. But then all of a sudden, everything kind of broke down. They had a closed door, hush-hush meeting earlier in the week, and they got into this debate on whether to vote on an anti-hate measure in response to Omar. Certain members of the caucus rose up and said, "Why are you singling her out? Where, you know, where was your, you know, voice when Donald Trump was out here saying all this stuff?" What's going on there, and what do you think is emblematic of?
Yeah, you know, it's such an interesting question. I really see this as another manifestation of this battle within the Democratic Party between the polarizing far left and the unifying Democratic leadership that is trying to do the right thing, basically. And it reminds me of the Ralph Northam situation, yes. In which, you know, here he is photographed either dressed up in blackface or as a Klansman in a photo that he apparently chose to appear in his yearbook. And boy, if a Republican had done that, we yeah. would have rightfully run them out of office, and I would have been a part of that effort.
Yep.
You know, but if it's a Democrat, then and I know some Democrats like this, and I've had conversations with them about it. And they play the whataboutism game on that one. Well, you know, why would we run Governor Northam out if, you know, we've got so many problems with racism on the right? Why do we have to single out Northam? Well, the reality is we got to get rid of all these guys. And most of them these days, sadly, are on the right. But I don't want them to have a home in either party, frankly. And I think we all ought to be united and, you know, and push them all out. And, you know, just deprive them of political space and oxygen to use. And we just can't have a place for that in this country. But I do think that there are sort of tribal members of both parties, and they're in the Democratic Party as much as they're in the Republican Party, who just can't get on board with holding their own accountable to uphold our values and our norms and our institutions. And of course, you know, I think the bigger problem right now is with the Republican Party under Trump's leadership. It pains me to say that, and I hope it doesn't last, but that's the way it is. But there is a real problem with this tribalism in that it fogs your brain, and you can't speak truth when and act responsibly when somebody of your own tribe has transgressed in some way.
Right.
And it holds us back as a country.
Well, it does. I think one of the things that kind of twists me on this episode, because you're right, with respect to the Democrats, it is a reflection of sort of that internal whataboutism that, you know, sort of gets you to a point where nothing happens. But then you have the president who tweets out on this thing, on this episode, calling it, quote, shameful. The Democrats were taking a stronger, you know, stand against anti-Semitism in their ranks. And then I'm sitting there and thinking to myself, wait a minute. You equivocated on the racial attack in Charlottesville because there are good people on both sides.
Yeah.
You profanely described third world countries as shitholes. And then you criticize black athletes for exercising their First Amendment rights under the Constitution.
Right.
And yet, all of a sudden, now you find this, you can speak out on this to be shameful. That for me, you know.
That's rich, isn't it?
It is. It really is. It really is. And it speaks to a broader frustration that a lot of us have within the party about, can we at least be consistent? And I think you put it exactly right. We're going to call it out on both sides at all times.
Exactly.
But it has to start when it happens in your own backyard. You have to start when you look at members of your own family showing their ass, as my mama used to say. You got to call him out on that. All right? You got to call him out. Put your pants back on, boy. Get in the house, you know? That's what you got to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We do just have to do that. And let me say, you know, certainly Trump is in no position to comment either way on this. I mean, he sort of has a knack for this. You know, he's sort of a Russian puppet, and he's called out for that. And then all of a sudden he's calling everybody else a puppet, or he's guilty, apparently, based on what we already know, of some campaign finance crimes, mm-hmm. and has sort of been implicated in them, I should say, has not been declared guilty, but he has been implicated in those crimes. And, you know, then he points the finger at everybody else, and everybody else is a criminal. People say he's a racist, which I think he is. And, you know, he points the finger at everybody else saying the same. And that's just one of his tactics, right? And
right.
What he wants is everybody to be pulled down into that muddy swamp with him, so that we've all got mud and junk all over
right.
our faces, and so that we all look like him. And that's not a good place for us to be. And we've got to make sure that we don't get there. And the way we don't get there is standing up and policing our own, as Democrats are trying to do, Democratic leadership is trying to do, and as more Republicans should try to do. And I, you know, we did, you know, the super PAC that I, my super PAC that I run with Mindy Finn and I, the American Values PAC, we put our money where our mouth was, we had donors who stood with us, obviously, and we were, you know, the largest outside player in standing against Steve King in Iowa, and you know, we helped drop his margin of victory from 25% down to 3%. And you know what? We're not done there. And so we're putting our money where our mouth is, and I would just ask all Democrats and Republicans to join that effort, you know, either directly or in spirit. I mean, we're Americans first, and let's stand up for our values. I promise you, it feels great. It feels great to put party aside and stand up for the country and our values first.
Well, they're words of inspiration. You're absolutely right. Evan McMullen, he's one of the good guys, folks. And certainly check out the work that he's doing over at Stand Up Republic. And you can check him out at standuprepublic.com. You can follow Evan on Twitter at Evan McMullen. Evan, I appreciate you, man. You keep that voice strong out there, brother. I got your back all the way.
Likewise, Michael. Take care.
All right.
Talk soon.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You got it. All right, folks. That does it for this episode. Please check us out on all those wonderful little podcast outlets. And download and get in the groove with the Man of Steel. But before I go, just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know, it happens to most of us at some point or another. Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is. How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, "How can we make this much and still have so much debt?" Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. And now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save. And take control of your finances with a loan from BestEgg.com. Visit BestEgg.com/plan. That's BestEgg.com/plan. The Michael Steele Podcast. Catch you next time.